The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating. We really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking about this hidden gap that exists in the geological record. If you go to the Grand Canyon and look at the layers of rocks laid down over history, there's something missing, and that separates rocks before life and rocks in the world where life is abundant. We'll be trying to get to the bottom of that mystery and why that gap exists on this week's episode. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and joining us via the internet is Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and from NUI Galway, Dr. Jessamine Fairfield. You're both very welcome. Shane, I believe you have a new book out. You are now an author, which is irritating.
Yes, I have. So myself and my colleague Declan Fahey have written a children's book about science. It's called Peggy's Adventures in Science, and it's a storybook for the youngest children, so 4 and 5 year olds. And it celebrates diversity and inclusion in science. And there's some wacky adventures that Peggy the Cocker Spaniel gets up to.
It's very cute and really well illustrated. And I think illustration is a huge part of children's books because parents want to look at something that's beautiful as well, like genuinely. And I think that's why Oliver Jeffery's books have been so pretty well received. And your book, Peggy's Adventures in Space, really, really nice. It does sort of dumb down the whole, you know, process of becoming an astronaut, I found. That Peggy, the only requirement for Peggy to get to space was just that they made her a suit, when really becoming an astronaut is a little bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, but having a penis seems to be hugely helpful for becoming an astronaut. So what we're celebrating is the fact that, like, you know, maybe we can have diverse groups of people going into space, and Peggy has to get help from Anya the astronaut to build a spacesuit that would fit her. And that actually happened in real life, as you remember. When we reported on the show, there weren't enough spacesuits for women to go into space together. So people can find the book at peggysadventures.com, and schools will have received a free copy in the post this week.
God, you're good at that.
I am.
Thank you, Dr. Shane Bergen. Let's go into our first story. A supposed therapy for autism, Shane, being debunked.
Yeah, absolutely. This is work from Duke University and published in the New England Journal of Medicine, very reputable journal. And they've looked at a treatment, as you said, that's been used for quite a while for people living with autism, where they were given oxytocin, a hormone, and it was squirted up people's noses. And it was done to help people with autism, but there was never really any sort of explained scientific reason for the treatment. So
is this a really common treatment?
Well, I believe so. Yeah, but there's an awful lot of treatments for, like, mental health issues that have very little basis in science, but they're just done, and there isn't really an explanation for them. I'm a little uncomfortable with that. But this looked at 290 children ranging from 3 to 17 years of age. And they were stratified by the severity of their autism symptoms. And they took part in this randomized trial. So some were given the oxytocin and some were given a placebo. And they looked then at whether the oxytocin would have a measurable impact on the children's social abilities. And they found that there was no effect at all from the oxytocin. And so, like, absolutely none. So they were saying that, there's no point in even doing a second type of study in this. It's just dead in the water. I do find, more generally, though, like, these sorts of talk, I know living with autism can be complex, but I think it's also important to point out that there's an awful lot of conversation now about celebrating neurodiversity, and that this is a more complex issue than, say, just saying, you know, take this pill and your autism will go away and you'll become, quote unquote, more normal. I think we need to think about that in a more sophisticated way.
Absolutely agree with everything you said there, Shane. To be honest, you know, you could talk about that for quite some time. I know we've covered autism, neurodiversity and so on in the program. But I think we could be doing this for hours. So well put. Jessamine, your first story has to do with China and its love of coal.
It's love of coal and also increasingly of solar power. So this is a study that just came out from researchers at Tsinghua University as well as Harvard, that have basically shown that in the current Chinese economy, so they're to the point now where solar power actually has the same cost as coal-based power, which is incredible if you think back to, you know, 20, 30 years ago, where one of the main issues that was seen with solar power was the price, you know, the price of photovoltaic installations, the price of getting it to the appropriate places in the energy grid. So to have gotten to this point is really incredible. This is partly due to a big drop in price of installing new solar power that happened over the last decade or so. This is worldwide, not just in China. But I think China really benefits as well from being the major global producer of things like solar panels, as well as batteries. And so at the moment, like a third of new solar capacity in the entire world is being installed in China. And basically, these researchers were looking at the promise the Chinese government has made to reach net zero emissions by 2060. And is saying, you know, yeah, like that's very achievable. At the moment, China produces more solar energy than the US, than Germany. And basically, it has a lot of capacity as well. So if all of the available sites in the entire country of China were used to their capacity for solar energy, they would have 13 times what's needed for their grid. And that's not even including any other types of renewables, which they also have in plenty. So it's kind of an inspiring story in terms of other countries around the world. Now, obviously, you know, solar panels and solar energy in general does have some drawbacks, namely that, you know, it depends on the weather. So you need to have some sort of storage capacity for it as well in terms of batteries. Same thing is true for wind, obviously, and other things like that. And you also need a way to get it around the energy grid, right? So China, like a lot of places in the world, where they have the most capacity to produce solar power is not where the most people live. So they have the most capacity in the northwest of the country, but that's got a very low population density. Most of the population in China is in the southeast. So then the question becomes things like grid efficiency.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the same story in the US in terms of solar power and as well in Europe. So I think this really, you know, should be inspiring in terms of solving those problems so that we can get more out of the solar capacity that we already have.
What about the shelf life of these solar panels? It's great to get that sort of output, but is it something that needs to be replaced every 10 years?
That's a great question. And I think at the moment, the shelf life is pretty good, but it depends on how the installations are done, right? So photovoltaics, especially if they're based on semiconductors like silicon, like they need to be very well encapsulated, especially, you know, if they're in something like a desert where a lot of solar power comes from. You can have, you know, high winds, you can have kind of difficult environmental situations. But I think a lot of work has been done in improving the durability of these things over the last few decades, as well as the efficiency. And that's just getting better, especially as more places in the world are turning to solar, you know, the capacity to create really durable, really powerful, for lack of a better word, solar power is just getting better and better, which is great.
Shane, our third story has to do with our endless search for things like us. And in this case, it's planets like ours.
Yeah, this is work from Australian scientists published in Nature this week. And they've been using the LOFAR radio telescope to look at exoplanets. And people may be familiar with the idea of LOFAR because Ireland is part of LOFAR. In Birr County Offaly, we have part of this huge European-wide array. And it's a radio telescope. So it looks for very low frequency forms of light out in the universe. And what they've been able to do recently is to give the array effectively a pair of sunglasses. And it's able to filter out very radio bright objects in the sky so it can see fainter things. What they're doing now is they're able to filter out the radio waves from big stars, and they're able to see effects from planets that are orbiting them. And so in this work, they have identified 19 red giants with exoplanets around them. And they're saying they're interesting because they're in the so-called Goldilocks zone. You'll remember we spoke about Proxima B on this program many times, which is a planet orbiting a red giant. And it's thought that maybe planets like that are most likely to have liquid water and thus have life on them. So this is a whole new way of looking at exoplanets. And it's only the start because there's a whole new telescope coming called the Square Kilometre Array, a new version of it between Australia and South Africa. And they're saying LOFAR might be the pathfinder for the Square Kilometre Array to look deeper and look further into space for these planets.
Not to be a skeptic, but what is the benefit of finding more of what you've already found? If we've seen hundreds, of which we have, exoplanets, what does the investment of this work bring us in terms of new insights with another 300, for example?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Like, what's the point if we know of 3,000 or so of them? Why do we need to know about 6,000 of them if we can't know any better about one? So I guess with the development of this technology, it's not just about being able to see them with one form of telescope, but being able to see them with multiple forms of telescope, because they all give their own piece of information. So adding it all together can give a fuller picture, if you'll pardon the pun, of that exoplanet. And so some will be able to do perhaps forms of spectroscopy looking for signals of chemicals. Others might be able to tell the composition of the planet, whether it's rocky or not, distance from the star, temperature, radiation on the surface, all these things, whether it has a moon or not. We can now look for exomoons, because it's thought that moons might be important for having life on a planet. So there's lots of little bits, but it is literally needle in a haystack. Well, it's not literally, it's sort of needle in a haystack type of sort of science. And it's great that Ireland's part of it. Of course, the Australians are saying they're going to be the next big thing, and they're saying it all started with The Dish. Remember that famous film in the outback of Australia? It's a great film. Yeah, so that was some of the earliest radio telescope work. Peter Gallagher, an Irish scientist, is very, very into this field, so people want to read about him.
Jessamine, our final story has to do with something I'm very skeptical about, and that is so-called team flow. What is this about?
So the idea here is to try to answer the question of what's happening to your brain when you are completely absorbed in a group activity, you know, something like playing music together, playing team sports, even gaming. And I was a little bit skeptical, too, when I first saw this headline, because it's researchers from Caltech, and they basically published a paper saying that they looked at a group of people performing a team activity, and they actually found that their neural activity was going into sync, in some sense, going to what they called neural synchrony. And so it's building on this idea of flow, which you've probably heard about. It's an idea coined by the researcher Csikszentmihalyi, who's a Hungarian-American researcher. Basically, his concept of flow was a state where you're sort of balancing the skills that you have versus the challenge that you're facing. And especially in a situation where both the skills and challenge are high, you can experience intense focus, you know, lose awareness of yourself, the environment around you, even kind of have time seem to be flying by. And it's an incredible state for creative activities. He mostly wrote about it in terms of an individual's experience of flow, you know, doing something that you really love, presumably, and are good at, and in a challenging way. So it's not too easy, you're not getting bored, it's not too hard where you're getting frustrated. And there are neurological states associated with the state of flow. But it hadn't been looked at in groups before. And what these researchers from Caltech found is that there is a specific neural pattern that can be determined from groups that's different from individual flow experiences. And it's also different from sort of social, like, brain patterns. So the test that they used was basically getting these test subjects to play something that was a bit like Guitar Hero, you know, a music game where you're kind of trying to synchronize your behavior with some of the music. And they looked at individuals playing the game just without a partner. They looked at someone playing with a partner, but with sort of discordant music thrown in, and as well, two partners playing the game together with no impediments. And the way that they measured flow here, they both looked at brain waves, but they also looked at their response to just random beeps thrown in. So this is an external stimulus that when you get into this state of flow, your brain starts to just kind of like shut it out. Hmm. And they did find that there were differences in how individuals who were in the sort of flow state with a partner both experienced the external stimulus, and also that their brain waves were going into the sort of concentration state that was aligned with their partner. So to me, when I first saw this, I was like, I don't know that you can have a bunch of people's brains like remotely into some, you know, super state. That sounds a little bit far-fetched. But when you're looking at the same stimulus, you're experiencing the same sense of challenge and also mastery over that challenge, I kind of can understand it. And to me, it reminded me of my long ago experiences running a raiding guild in World of Warcraft. So, you know, getting together with 25 other really cool people who are not giant nerds from around the internet.
I didn't say anything.
Yeah, and doing these, like, you know, basically like team-based challenges where we all had different roles. We were all doing stuff that was hard but doable. And, you know, you would get to the end of a big boss fight and it was amazing. Like, you just feel really, like, in sync. The time flew by. And to me, it's really interesting that this concept of flow can be generalized to groups. I think more research is definitely needed. But it was pretty amazing to me to see that this is possible.
I have yet to reach, I suppose, that state of team flow that you describe there, Jessamine. Usually in football, I'm the one that they groan when they see me show up wagging tail and enthusiastic about bringing the entire team down.
Maybe you should try World of Warcraft.
Maybe. Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from NUI Galway and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. Thanks very much. And Shane, good luck with the book.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Now, in 1869, a one-armed, self-taught geologist led an expedition party down Green River in Wyoming. While staring up at the great walls of the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell noticed that the rock formations were less in depth than expected. By measuring the rock formations, Powell noticed something startling. There was more than a billion-year gap in the geological record. This has now been coined the Great Unconformity, and geologists are racing to track down the missing time. Joining me now is Associate Professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder. Her name is Becky Flowers. Becky, welcome to the program. Who was John Wesley Powell?
Hi, it's great to be here. Yeah, so John Wesley Powell, as you described, so he's a geologist and famous explorer who in 1869 was the first to raft through the Grand Canyon in his famous expedition exploring the Colorado River. He later became a director of the U.S. Geological Survey. But as you said, he was the first to notice and describe the Great Unconformity in the canyon.
So explain this to a non-geologist. How do you spot a billion missing years?
Yeah, well, so the Great Unconformity is, it's one of the most striking features in the geologic record. And so, and therefore it's one of the first well-described geologic features. And so the Great Unconformity is this iconic feature that is this knife-sharp boundary between older sort of crystalline basement rocks and younger layered sedimentary rocks. And this is a feature that occurs in various places around the globe and across North America. And so it's not until you actually radiometrically date different layers that you can determine quantitatively how much time is missing across that gap. But just by looking at this feature, it's pretty clear that there's a big contrast at this boundary that is very striking.
So you have over millennia, over hundreds of thousands of years, over millions of years, layers upon layers of rock that form over time. And then you have this thin slice and suddenly time jumps ahead a billion years. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So yeah, across this feature, there's this time gap that's missing is anywhere from a few hundred million years to 3 billion years. And so essentially, as you were saying, so you can have, for example, deposition and crystallization of rocks over a long period of time. But you can also have a hiatus, a stop in deposition, or you can have uplift and erosion across a feature. And so, you know, the geologic record that is preserved on Earth today is very incomplete. It's mostly incomplete. We have only a fragmentary record. And I think the Great Unconformity is one of the best illustrations of this, where in places there is such a dramatic time gap.
So when does this time gap fit in our history of the world?
Yeah, so the Great Unconformity, it's classically defined where you have this older basement that's older than about 500 million years, that is overlain by layered sedimentary rocks that typically as old as about 500 million years. And one of the striking things is the Great Unconformity typically marks where below the feature, there are no macroscopic fossils, whereas above the feature, within the layered sedimentary rocks, you see lots of macroscopic fossils. And so in this time interval, this is an interval when we have the Cambrian diversification of life, there are the snowball Earth glaciations that are happening within this window of missing time, there's the assembly and breakup of the Rodinia supercontinent. And so there's lots of things occurring within this window that in places is a time gap.
Okay, so I'm really confused because I thought the only way we could know about these formations moving around is through measuring rocks. And how do you do that if those rocks don't exist?
Yeah, okay, that's a great question. So the Great Unconformity is not exactly the same everywhere. And so in places you have 3 billion year old rocks overlain by 500 million year old rocks. In other places, you might have billion-year-old rocks overlain by 500 million-year-old rocks. And in still other places, you have between a billion and 500 million years, you might have glacial deposits that tell us about the location of the snowball Earth glaciations. So this is a heterogeneous feature that occurs worldwide that has different amounts of missing time. And in other locations, parts of that record are preserved.
So you've got thin slices and you've got thick slices of missing time, essentially.
Yes, that's right. You can think of it like that. That's okay, right.
So, considering you're talking about differences in some parts of the world of over a billion years, that is a remarkable difference in what's happening in one part of the world and what's not happening in another part of the world. How on earth do we explain something like that? I mean, I don't understand how something could be so active, laying down layers and layers and layers of rock for a whole billion years in one part of our planet, and then in the other part of our planet, practically nothing happened. So can you explain what sort of geological process might have either allowed this unlaying to have happened or erosion while preserving the rock that we do see from this period?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So one way to think about it is, what do we see on Earth today, right? In some places, we have big mountains that are being uplifted and are shedding sediments. They're eroding and shedding material, moving down through creeks and stuff out onto lower elevation regions, which are accumulating sedimentary rocks. So even on Earth today, we have highly heterogeneous sort of geologic histories that are in action, right? Uplift and erosion in some places, deposition in other locations, depending on where we are relative to plate boundaries on this planet. And so the same thing potentially, you know, is true back in, before 500 million years ago, that we have these heterogeneous histories. One way to potentially explain this missing gap in time is through the assembly and breakup of the Rodinia supercontinent, where you different plate. So today we have continents that are distributed around the planet in various points in the past. All of those continents have been assembled together. Your listeners may be more familiar with this Pangaea supercontinent, which is the most recent supercontinent that existed. There was an earlier supercontinent known as Rodinia that it existed in this sort of 800 million year to 500 million year range. And so that supercontinent assembled, and then by collisional plate boundaries, and then subsequently it broke apart in window that we're talking about.
Stop for a second. I thought Pangaea was the start. I thought it was one big mass of rock, and then it separated into the continent. You're telling me we had a Pangaea before Pangaea?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Exactly. So we've seen multiple cycles of supercontinent assembly and breakup on our planet.
I did not know that. Okay. Wow. Okay. Keep going. Sorry.
Okay. Where did I stop?
You were sort of explaining how we have lots of rock in some spot from the same part of time and none in another. And you were sort of saying that we have, you know, we've got mountains and so on. But I would have thought the top layer of the mountains is the current layer that we're laying down, which is also the current layer of ground level. No?
Actually, it's the opposite. So in places typically where you have high elevations, like in the Himalayas or, you know, here in the Rockies where I am, like the places where that are elevated are the places that are undergoing weathering and erosion. And then you think of all those river systems coming off the high regions that are transporting sediment into lower regions. So typically the places that are low in elevation are accumulating layers of sediment, which ultimately may turn into those layered sedimentary rocks. And the high regions are undergoing erosion. So over the long term in these high regions, if later different things happen to them, these high regions, and they evolved through time and continents broke apart and they became the low regions, you might have younger sedimentary rocks deposited in that now eroded sort of mountain belt with a big gap in time between the place that was previously eroded and the sediments that were deposited on top.
So is that a theory for what could have happened with this billion year gap, that essentially there was a series of giant glaciers that moved?
Yeah, so there's a number of different theories for how the Great Unconformity may have developed. And so, as you just said, one of these is back in this missing window largely missing window of time, at least at the Great Unconformity. We know that there were multiple snowball Earth glaciations, and so these glaciers largely covered the planet. And one hypothesis is that these glaciers caused multiple kilometers of erosion globally, essentially synchronously at one time, and that generated this distinctive feature that we see today. Another hypothesis is more along the lines of what I was just talking about, where we have in the same time window, we have the assembly of the continents into the Virginia supercontinent and then the subsequent breaking up of that. And in that scenario, we might expect earlier erosion to have led to the development of the Great Unconformity erosion surface earlier than the snowball Earth glaciations in some locations. But in other locations, we might expect erosion to be later, depending on the tectonic processes that are happening in individual locations. And so in order to discriminate among those hypotheses, what you need to know is, when did erosion occur? And so we have new analytical techniques that allow us to figure that out. And so in the snowball Earth scenario, we would expect one distinctive global, you know, erosion event that happens everywhere, synchronous with the snowball Earth glaciations. Yeah. In the Rodinia hypothesis, we should see a more heterogeneous history.
Okay. And so that means lots of drilling, or do we not need to drill to test these theories?
We don't need to drill. So what we can do is go out to locations like in the Grand Canyon, where we can collect samples from right below the Great Unconformity. And we can use analytical tools to date minerals in those rocks, with which we can constrain thermal histories, which can tell us something about the erosion history that led to the development of that feature.
You were saying that there's not many fossils. There wasn't much of an example of life before this line. Do we know why that is?
I mean, this is something that lots of scientists are working on. I mean, there is our microscopic fossils in earlier in time, but in terms of, you know, what in the Cambrian, we see this dramatic Cambrian explosion, Cambrian diversification of life. And so this is one reason why there's such intense interest in this interval of time, is to try to understand what is the relationship between major erosion and tectonics and climatic and environmental change with the rise of complex life.
When you say explosion of life in the Cambrian, what are you talking about?
So I'm talking about, you think about fossils that you can go out and collect in the rock record. You know, you don't typically have fossils to collect until the Cambrian, until 500 million years ago. Before that time, life was not nearly as abundant or large in size.
How important is it to sort of understand why we have this sort of thin and thick layer across the world? Why is that important?
Well, it's important because this isn't such a critical interval of Earth history, where we're having this dramatic climatic and environmental and biologic and tectonic change. Again, this interval where there's these multiple snowball Earth events, when we have this Cambrian diversification of life. And so, you know, there are just some fundamental questions about the interactions of different Earth systems, like the interaction between the solid Earth beneath our feet and the climate system and the biologic system. And so, you know, certainly right now we're in a time of climatic and environmental change. And so understanding how these different Earth systems interact is important for just gaining insight into how our planet works more generally and how it will continue to evolve into the future.
And I suppose it's been one of those puzzles that's been around quite some time. Charles Darwin was actually confounded by this phenomenon, right?
Yeah. I mean, he said, you know, that the sudden appearance of complex macroscopic fossils in these Cambrian strata above the Great Unconformity suggested a singular global event. So even back then, you know, they're thinking about what is the significance of this feature for the evolution of life.
Right. And is there a theory out there that suggests that something happened during this billion year gap that essentially made life 100 times, a million times more possible?
Yeah. I mean, because this feature does occur right below where we see this sort of Cambrian explosion and the occurrence of all these fossils, this has led to the idea that major erosion occurred right before the Cambrian explosion, and that there's the concept that, you know, major erosion delivers key nutrients like phosphorus to the oceans that may have enhanced the generation of life. But in order for that to be true, in order, you know, we we need actual temporal constraints on when that erosion event occurred. Because if that erosion event occurred right before the Cambrian diversification of life, that suggests maybe there is a causal link. But if the major erosion occurred 500 million years before the Cambrian explosion, there's probably not a direct causal link. And so this requires going out and working on different exposures to determine the timing of the event.
Right. And do we see, I mean, obviously the beginning of life, it can only really happen once, but do we see after erosions, a huge amount of diversity at any other period of time? Do you know what I mean?
I think not. Yeah, I know what you're saying. Not in the same dramatic way that we see at the Great Unconformity. Unconformities are very common in the rock record. Unconformities are simply gaps in the sequence of rocks, and those occur all over the place. This one is just so dramatic because it does occur. It's so distinctive in the rock record, and because it does typically mark the boundary between mostly unfossiliferous units and fossiliferous units that overlie this feature, and because the time gap is so extensive.
That's really interesting hearing about this. I hadn't heard of this billion year gap in the rock and how significant understanding it could really be. Dr. Rebecca Flowers from the University of Colorado Boulder, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
It is sometimes hard to lift geology as a science up off the page and make it fascinating and engaging because it's such a slow moving science. But I thought that was really fascinating. Love to hear your comments and questions. You can email us science@newstalk.com or tweet us. We're @NewstalkScience. So now it's time to look back at some of your comments from last week's episode. And do, if there's something in your mind, do share. We do like hearing your comments, even if they are insulting or rude. It's something to do, isn't it? Producer Aidan McKelvey joins me to go through them. How are you? You've been on holidays. So you're finally back.
I have, yeah. That made us sound very desperate. Just talk to us about anything.
Do you think? I genuinely mean, you know, I'm okay to riff off anything. I'm all right with that. You know, I did a talk show for many years, and you know, there's long times where you had no callers and you just had to talk. You just had to talk for long periods of time about nothing. So
that explains a lot of our conversations.
It does. It does, doesn't it? Yeah. How was your holiday and where did you go?
It was lovely. I was in Germany between Dusseldorf and Cologne, and I also took a couple of days to go to Luxembourg.
Oh, I was trying, like everybody does. Why
yeah,
not?
Yeah, when I try and tick off all the countries, might as well go to Luxembourg. Luxembourg is really nice.
Is it?
I would recommend it to people.
Really? Yeah. Luxembourg is like if
fancy
you...
fancy castles.
If you were to list off all the countries in Europe, Luxembourg is the one you'd forget.
Yeah, well, I've been to like a lot of those little micronations. And I have to say, they're all pretty good. Like I was in Liechtenstein, I was in San Marino, Vatican City. They have their own little kind of weird bit of history and character.
Yeah.
So I like Luxembourg a lot. I would recommend it, especially Luxembourg City. Is quite an epic location. It's like a mountain with a valley all around it. And, you know, the reason it's a city is because the king built a castle there and there's only one way up and the castle defended the kind of mountain. So you've kind of this view around the valley. It's very nice.
Hang on there. Let me just Google this castle of Luxembourg of which you speak and I'll give it a rating for our listeners out of 10.
Well, there's no castle left because there's like a castle bridge and then there's the city where the castle would have been.
That's kind of nice.
Yeah, it's very
nice. Wait, there's a picture of you visiting it on the internet.
Really?
I know. Actually, on closer inspection, it's just another hipster. But it really looks like you from, like in low res. Sorry, that was a cheap dig, wasn't it? And I'm glad you're back. Your service in the production of this show that we do is pretty vital.
Sometimes you're going to say like, is sort of grand. And,
no,
relatively
no.
unnoticed.
No. Let's get to your comments from last week. Aoife Braden says, "Hi, Aidan and Jonathan. Like they included you in the email, or did you put your own name in there? No one ever says hi, Aidan."
No, it's true. Nobody ever says hi, Aidan. But this person actually did.
Oh, well, that's lovely.
Yeah, nice, warm, fuzzy feeling for me.
There you go. She says, "I was listening to your show last week with Dave Hone, who is a paleontologist who used to work in UCD. And that's how we've had him on the program. Really enthusiastic guy, as I said last week." And she said, "I really enjoyed your piece with Dave about the Isle of Wight dinosaurs. If you wanted to do a follow-up piece on Irish dinosaurs, the best person is Mike Sims in the Ulster Museum in Belfast. He can definitely match Dave's enthusiasm. He's a paleontologist who's done lots of work on fossils found in Antrim. Oh, no, wait, sorry. On fossil found in Antrim is what she says, which I think is actually accurate. I think Ireland has, the whole island of Ireland has like one fossil is my memory. But he also has good knowledge of fossils and geology across Ireland. He's also an avid caver and has great stories. I would imagine like he's, if you were a paleontologist in Ireland, you'd have to bulk up the rest of your stuff. Like you'd have to also like, I've got loads of stuff on geology and I'm a caver and I've got great other stories that have nothing to do with fossils, because literally there's that one dinosaur in Antrim, I think. And it, like, obviously it's not a big specimen either. I think it's like a toenail of a dinosaur. I'm going to get in trouble for that, but
is
I do
like
think
the
it's really small.
Paleontologist, since we only have like one.
I don't know if he's based in Ireland or he's in museum, Ulster Museum, Belfast. I don't think he's like from the Republic of Ireland. Not that that matters. I'm not getting all nationalist about paleontology. That'd be flipping weird. But I think, yeah, we don't have a huge amount of paleontologists because we haven't got a huge amount of bones here, is what I said last week, because I was really jealous that in the Isle of Wight, like you could trip over a rock and like you'd look at it and you'd be like, there'd be like dinosaur heads coming out of it.
Yeah, I was glad you actually asked that, because I'd often wondered why we didn't have any dinosaurs. I just thought we were lazy or crap.
It wasn't a great response, to be honest. But like, I think the answer is that we have softer sediment here off the coast of the Irish Sea. And so we don't, it's the type of stone doesn't hold on to fossils very well.
Yeah, just the wrong type of rock.
Yeah. Ain Diarg got in contact on Twitter and he says, brilliant, fantastic show. And then I thought, like, you know, if I was a tweeter, I'd say, I'd leave it at that. But then he goes on to say, you've made my day. And at this point, I'm thinking, is he being sarcastic? And then he finishes off with, I have a big smile on my face. And I'm like, damn, I know you're being sarcastic at that stage. Like, you just don't do that in the tweet, do you? Brilliant, fantastic show. You've made my day. Big smile on my face. Like, do you think he was being...
Well, I don't know. Clearly, the negativity of social media has finally broken you.
I was broken a long time ago. Right, I think that's it. So, if you would like to add to the comments for next week's program, please email us science@newstalk.com. No subject required, and no subject is taboo. Particularly since we were talking about BDSM and pain and pleasure this week. That's on the next episode, but definitely stuff to talk about there. Have you ever met anyone, Aidan, who you suspected was into BDSM? I didn't want to ask you directly, are you into BDSM? I thought that would be one step too close. But like, is... Like, I know one person, a friend of mine confided in me and said, yep, into that sort of stuff. And I was very surprised. But I guess we need to push past those boundaries, right?
Well, it's fine to be surprised. Yes, to answer your question, yes, I do. I do know certainly one person, maybe people, but it's perfectly fine to be surprised.
How did you find out?
They just told me.
Oh, right.
What I liked about it, I kind of respected that the person in question was just like totally upfront about it. And as you were kind of alluding to there, you know, there's nothing wrong with what consenting adults did, and they were just, I'm into this. No, indeed. No kind of qualms about saying it.
Yeah.
And I kind of respected that.
Yeah. Fair news. Sure. All right, well, that concludes this podcast in a rather unusual note. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, Simon Keane, Garrett Mahal, Steve McLoone on sound. We have that episode on pleasure from pain on Tuesday in the Future Proof Extra. But more Future Proof back again, of course, on Sunday because it's our new day for a podcast. In case you had noticed, we'll chat to you then. In the meantime, stay curious.